Hello, my name is Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors at Computer Weekly, here to bid you a very warm welcome indeed to the Computer Weekly
Downtown Upload podcast.
And those two other voices were?
I'm Caroline Donnelly, I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
I'm Claire MacDonald, I'm the business editor at Computer Weekly.
And Caroline's back in her rightful place, having missed last week's podcast.
A very lively one, I understand.
You say you understand.
Well, I haven't listened to it yet, so apologies, but I'm sure it's brilliant, award-winning even. So I'll catch up.
It's probably because you were busy voting.
Yes, of course, yes. Mm-hmm. Exercising my democratic right.
And following the saga of Theresa May and her final announcement of her departure today.
Mm. I know, that's quite dramatic.
7th of June. Going.
Yeah, which is my birthday, so it's quite a gift, really. I'm happy.
It's easily remembered, then.
Although, it's that's just the date of when she's standing down as Conservative leader, isn't it? So, it's
So, she remains our Prime Minister, then?
Yeah, I think she's caretaker Prime Minister for a little while yet, until they find a successor.
Mm.
So, probably just spinning around in their chair. We're like, do you want to give a speech? No,
not really. Yeah, not really.
Yeah, she does seem a bit kind of up yours to everyone at the moment, doesn't she?
She had a bit of a cry, didn't she? Which I quite like.
Yeah.
When she resigned. And she said that it was a high honour to be.
Was she bubbling this morning when she was announcing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a nice show of humanity, really.
Yeah, it's maybe a bit long overdue, showing a bit of the human side. You know, there's the reputation that she is the Maybot.
She did have that dance that time.
Yeah,
little.
I suppose that's a show of some form of humanity. But although a lot of her policies in the past haven't exactly.
there is a fair amount of comments saying that's quite unedifying seeing these kind of gangs of men hounding her out of office.
Yeah,
yeah.
And there was the Metro headline this morning. Did you see that?
Mm-mm.
Where it's basically like, "Oh, tell her, Phil." So like basically making the point that maybe her husband should tell her, like, come on, wind your neck in, love, stand down, which is a bit like, I'm not sure I agree with that.
No, like, you don't need your husband to tell you, don't need a husband to be told what to, I hate everyone.
Well, there we go. it's not particularly, I don't know if, cover themselves in glory with that kind of narrative, really.
No.
Metro.
What a good way to put it, Caroline. Rather than just making noises.
Yes.
Of frustration.
The voice of reason has returned to the podcast.
Hi.
After last week's anarchy.
Yeah, wow. Hmm. You can't expect me and Ryan to be kept under control.
I suppose not. So today we've got a lot to chew through. Just pick a few highlights. Without going through everything I'm going to talk about. Caroline, you're going to be talking about Amazon and its shareholders.
Yeah.
Claire, you were at Salesforce World Tour yesterday.
Yes. And then on Wednesday, I was at Future Stores in Twickenham.
So you've got a lot of retail-y stuff to be talking about. I might chip in with that because I was doing some fireside chatting yesterday at Atlassian's Future of Work event in London, and one of my lovely panellists is someone who's worked at the John Lewis Partnership for a long time.
Oh, cool.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about what she said and the other panellists and so on.
Nice.
But let's begin with Caroline on Amazon shareholders, are they in revolt? Is that too simplistic?
No, I think that's a fair summary, really. So Amazon had its annual meeting the other week, and they're always quite useful for us to track at Computer Weekly because it kind of gives you a sense of, I guess, the direction of travel that the company's in. But there's been quite a lot of anticipation around this one for a few reasons, and that's because there's been quite a lot of, I guess, hoo-ha in the run-up to it around a couple of proposals that have been put forward about things that were going to get voted on at this meeting. And one of them is something that we talked about in, I can't remember the number of the podcast, but I've got a few podcasts ago, that there was a shareholder-backed bid for Amazon to halt sales of its facial recognition software. Recognition.
With a key.
Yes, you remember.
Oh, yeah, yes. I remember that chat too.
Yeah, so that was one of the things they were going to vote on. And the other thing they were going to vote on was a proposal that was put forward by shareholders, but it's also had quite a lot of backing from its staff as well, is that they want Amazon to produce an annual report about its climate change preparation.
Yeah, and on a previous podcast you were talking about Greenpeace.
Yeah, and that's another part of it. They also want Amazon to start using less fossil fuels, which is exactly what Greenpeace have been on at them about for ages. So these were kind of two big proposals that were supposed to be voted on, and in response to both of them, the vote was so they just the board of directors and the shareholders, they voted, they had to hit a threshold of 50%, and the vote was we're going to continue sales of the facial recognition software to government agencies. That was the thing. It's not just halt the sales completely, it's specifically to government agencies.
Yeah.
And we're not going to produce a report about our climate change preparation. And as for fossil fuels, well, yeah. So in terms of why, they the results weren't actually that surprising. In the proxy statement in the run-up to the meeting about like what's going to be voted on, Amazon's board of directors said, we recommend you vote against every proposal in it, including the climate change ones and the AI sales thing as well.
Sure.
So as to why they got voted down, the proxy statement kind of gives an idea as to why Amazon's take on this. And they basically said that from the recognition perspective, they've never had a single report about it being used in a harmful manner, which is kind of interesting. But if you're using technology in a harmful way, are you going to put your hand up and go, hey, we're actually using this really badly. Sorry, we're using it for like evil deeds. Like, we're using it for racial profiling and, you know, just bad things. You're not going to do that. And as for the climate change side of things, they've sort of said, as they did in the Greenpeace kind of story the other week, that we're doing lots of stuff. Already, we're doing, you know, we've made a commitment that 50% of all Amazon shipments will be zero carbon by 2030. So we are doing things, so we don't think we need to do other measures as proposed.
But the point about the facial recognition software, just like with any technology, you know, people can use it for harm. We can't really do anything about that. That's what really made my jaw drop. It's basically saying, like, not our responsibility. And with the no filed complaints about it having been used for racial profiling and stuff like that, that is also very much about the data that gets fed into it. Right.
Yeah.
So if there is a bias already in those organizations, it's going to come out in the technology.
Where technology is not neutral.
Yeah, isn't it part of their responsibility to make sure that it can be used in a good way?
But this is quite interesting because Amazon have kind of gone full pelt at this. That we're just, you know, we're going to continue sending it to government agencies. It's being evaluated by law enforcers as well. Whereas meanwhile, on the other side of things, Google have said, we've got facial recognition technology, but we're not going to sell it until there's proper policies and regulations in place to make sure it's used properly.
Okay.
So that's that side of the argument as well. And the shareholders, actually, as you mentioned, is it a shareholder revolt? The organisation who kind of mobilised them, if you like, to sort of write this letter to say, look, we're opposed to this. They've released a statement, and it's been, I think it was on Gizmodo, I was reading earlier, basically saying they think it's commercially arrogant of Amazon to just carry on and ignore shareholders, which I think is a really, really good point here. These are, both those proposals are things that their shareholders have said they feel strongly about this. And like I say, the climate change part of it, that there's like a climate change kind of protest movement within Amazon, within its staff. It's got, and 7,000 of their staff signed this letter saying, we want this proposal, we want you to do more on climate change. So they're more in their staff's wishes as well. And I know it's a huge organisation, maybe 7,000 people is like a drop in the ocean, but when you've got organisations like Google who are taking a stance on facial recognition, we've also written a lot recently on a lot of the stuff that Google's doing around, I mean, in terms of carbon neutral policies, they've been carbon neutral for over a decade in terms of their operations. And when I was at the Google Cloud conference a few weeks ago, some of the stuff they're doing in their data centers in terms of ensuring everything that might run fossil fuels is offset by an equal investment in renewable energy. They're using machine learning to kind of predict when they can make sure like the highest percentage possible of their data centers are running on renewable energy and stuff like that. It's real kind of amazing technology they're throwing at it. And you kind of think with their staff, you know, if you're seeing companies within kind of the tech space who are kind of doing really, really positive stuff from kind of climate change and environmental perspective, will that make them think, okay, well, I've got skills here, there's much of a muchness with technology. Could they just hop, like, jump ship, like, okay, maybe we'll go to Google. Their alignment on these topics is more in keeping with my own, and that's a company that I want to be, you know, I'd rather work at or something like that.
Yeah, and that's why I think that that term, commercially arrogant, is, like, just so spot on. Because if you look at even the retail space, which we were talking about in the last podcast, retailers are being led by what consumers want, and it's the same with employees. Mm-hmm. Like you said, if I worked at a company that didn't align with my values and I felt as though I could be doing the same job but at a company that was doing better for the world, why wouldn't you just jump ship, you know? I think that it is arrogant for them to think that, oh yeah, we're a world superpower in all of the markets and there's, you know, like, nothing that anyone can do to make us do things different. We're always going to be on top. I don't think that's true.
Maybe they think it's enough to be named after the Amazon rainforest.
Well, might all be gone if they carry on.
Especially will be gone if they keep packaging things the way that they do.
Oh, no, they have said they've made concessions around reducing the environmental impact of their packaging. That was in the proxy statement. That's in terms of their as to why they don't need to do anything else. You know, they don't need to do more because they're actually tackling all this stuff. But that's one of the things about this, though, is that a shareholder meeting is a very public statement saying, no, we reject these ideas. And it's fine if you're doing all this stuff in the background, but publicly you've been seen to just go, no, I reject this, we reject that. How many people are going to look into the reasoning behind it? They're just going to say, oh wow, they reject regulation on AI, they reject, like, you know, combating climate change, right? That's, I think, and that really, from an outsider's point of view, I think could potentially be damaging even for Amazon as a brand, just to, although they are doing stuff and they maintain they're doing stuff in the background, I think they maybe need to look at how this looks to outsiders, rather than, particularly as a lot of the company meeting, from what I gather, was talking about how successful they are. So it's like, so are you all so pursuing profit that you don't consider the wider implications of what you're up to?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't the city of San Francisco, haven't they announced a ban on facial recognition tech by law enforcement?
Mm-hmm. And I think, because a lot of the use cases that Amazon shares around facial recognition is how it's being used in law enforcement. Like, we wrote a case study a couple of years ago now about how it's being used to help track down victims of child trafficking. So I think they kind of put forward those use cases that, look, it's not trying to identify criminals, it's trying to help children. Like, come on, guys, like, how can you hate facial recognition?
Yeah.
It's like, it's doing a great job. Like, God, you must really love child trafficking.
What a stance to take.
Yeah, so obviously they didn't say that, but that's the kind of, part of it. So it's interesting. Like I say, there are other companies who seem to be, like I say, how much competition there is in the public cloud space. And we've talked before about how there are things that are emerging now where maybe Amazon could potentially lose ground in some markets because of competitive pressures. So and maybe lose market share to Microsoft and Google for certain things. So could sustainability be an area that they end up kind of
Achilles heel for the organisation?
Yeah, particularly, like I say, we've already talked about Google, but when you talk to a lot of Google customers, when you say, oh, why did you go with Google, not Amazon, why not Microsoft? You get, like, the usual reasons, oh, you know, innovation, we wanted to do AI. And then it is, like, on sustainability, there was a session with Etsy at their big Google Cloud Next couple of weeks
ago. Carolyn, with whom?
Etsy.
Right.
The sort of online marketplace things, like
handmade goods.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they sort of said, oh, the reason we decided to close down all our data centres and move to Google Cloud was, you know, a big part of it was sustainability, but also diversity and inclusion around, because Etsy have this thing, because so much of the people who sell stuff on their platform are female, they try to make sure that their workforce represents its user base, so they try to have parity with various gender metrics. So, it is happening more and more when you talk to cloud buyers, but they are getting more concerned about the sustainability within their supply chain. So you do wonder if this, I don't know, could be an Achilles heel, like you say, going forward.
Certainly a kind of big seam of stories for you.
Can't wait. Get serious. Stuck in. Yeah. Well, I was going to blog about some of these, the wider issues, and actually our colleague Sebastian, who is big on all the kind of surveillance, facial recognition, privacy concerns, stuff, he's going to do a deep dive into a lot of this, I think, in the coming weeks. Nice. We were talking about this morning, so yeah, so lots to come.
Perhaps we should discuss that with him on a later podcast.
We definitely should do that thing. So Amazon pushing its luck with AI, which mm-hmm. leads me, I'm just going to touch on this briefly, but there was a story this week that Angelica Murray wrote up for us on the UK leading in government AI readiness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a report from an outfit called Oxford Insights and a Canadian organisation called the International Development Research Centre. Oxford Insights, I couldn't see any connection to the University of Oxford. But I'm sure there's a very good reason for the name of this company, mm-hmm. and this research organisation, which is headed up by a chap called Richard Stirling, who was at the ODI cabinet office, mm-hmm. so he's pretty obviously plugged in to government stuff on AI. They surveyed 194 odd countries to see how AI ready they were, and we came out almost top.
Really?
Yeah.
Go UK.
Yeah, just behind our former colony, Singapore. So this all bodes very well for Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
We will be so gung-ho on AI and ready for it.
How are they determining readiness?
This I haven't looked to in any great detail. That's just the headline I had from it.
Oh.
Mm.
It just... I'm not sure if the future workforce is quite ready. Quite
I think it's stuff like education. I mean, the UK has been investing a lot in higher education for AI.
Mm-hmm.
I know these sites, the story sites, AI research studentships, PhD studentships at mm-hmm. Imperial College.
Okay.
And we spoke in an earlier podcast about the very concerted effort that the government has been making in terms of putting resources into postgraduate education and AI. So there's something in it.
It's just whether kids actually understand AI. There was a class that I went to teach... Well, I was meant to be there to teach them how to be digital journalists, but we got on to sort of technology roles, and when I mentioned AI... There was a bit of a, what's that? Can you give me some examples?
Mm-hmm.
So what examples did you give?
So chatbots mm-hmm. and...
cool, that's a good one.
Checkouts, self-checkouts.
Yeah.
In some cases.
Yeah.
Things like
I suppose
that.
The big one that a lot of people give is, in terms of machine learning, is back to Amazon, the recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought chatbots might be a good one for kids.
Definitely.
If they've been on Facebook or if they've been on a website. Or
like
Alexa
stuff as well. Yeah. They know that. Yeah. It's like a...
Absolutely, they do know that. And they're very rude to Alexa. Children.
Yeah. My nephew had a thing where he was like, Alexa, are you hungry? And she was like, no, I'm very well fed. And he goes, but are you tired then? Because he hadn't said Alexa. She didn't answer the second question. And he went into like a complete pit of despair. Like, she's not even answering.
Well, that's better than going completely ballistic.
Yeah,
with,
that's what I mean. He's been raised right. So it just
makes me laugh. Yeah, it's very heartening to know that we're so high up in this... in this list, I must confess, I don't know the ins and outs of the research that Oxford Insights and the IDRC did, but on this occasion, I'm just going to take their word for it, that we're ready, ready to go, we're high up.
Cool.
So,
get going.
What's not to like? But there is, and I've said this on previous podcasts, there is that element of chest-beating nationalism around this, which doesn't seem entirely appropriate for such an advanced technology. So from politics of nationalism, possibly, to the values of diversity. Claire, there's a story this week, wasn't there, that caught your attention about O2?
Yeah, so this was written by our colleague Alex Scroxton, and it was about O2 introducing resources to support trans employees. So employees within O2 that are transitioning and their managers.
So it's a toolkit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means, but...
So I think part of the point is to make sure that O2 is providing an inclusive environment. So if someone starts to transition, they can still feel like they can be themselves in the workplace. They're contributing their best self so that they can, you know, like make sure that O2's still being as innovative as possible. We've spoken about the importance of diversity in workplaces for innovation before.
Yeah.
They just want to make sure that people feel supported. There was a JISC network shop that I went to once where one of the speakers was trans. And she was saying that before she transitioned, one of the things that actually gave her away before she was prepared to announce it to some of her colleagues was her iPad. Because on her iPad she was already using the female gender and a female name.
Okay.
So when she loaded, you know, like loaded up her iPad, it said something to her like, oh, yeah. Hey, and she was a bit like, oh, and all of her colleagues were like, why is your iPad calling you a girl name, and you know, things like that. When is it time to tell your colleagues? How do you tell them? Is your manager going to be on side? What language should be used?
Yeah.
These are all things that I think would be very helpful in a toolkit for this kind of thing. Mm. And it's just, it's good to feel supported. I think even if you don't want to use it, knowing that it's there just makes you feel like all of the options have been thought about, that your business is on side with you. They also launched an International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia and Biphobia, which I thought was really important. It was on the 17th of May. I guess just for awareness, you know. We ain't gonna put up with any of that type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also, not necessarily on the LGBT side specifically, but they also introduced paid paternity leave. So that could be for any, you know, like gender relationship. So if you're in a gay relationship, for example, and then you have a baby, you can have paid paternity leave. Which would be helpful, but also helpful for straight couples.
Cool. You know, so it sounds like Telefonica stroke O2 is doing good stuff.
I think that this was amazing, and part of the research that went towards it, because they got help from the Stonewall charity to help them implement it, because it's good to have experts helping you to implement these things. And they said that they'd done research that found that half of trans people had hidden their identity from colleagues at work, which I just think is horrible. Imagine not being able to
be yourself.
There is that thing, isn't there, like innovation happens when people feel safe, but to share ideas and, and every part of them as well. So if you're thinking, right, okay, I've got to keep part of me held back, you probably will not feel confident to put yourself forward, put your ideas forward, or contribute in other ways as well.
Organisations don't get the benefit of the talent of their workers. So, there's that too.
Yeah, I feel like a little bit of you is behind a wall.
And a company that is quite good in diversity, shall we say, is Salesforce. You were visiting their world tour.
So Salesforce have always been massive advocates of diversity.
Was it down at the Excel?
It was at the Excel, which I usually have the opinion that the Excel isn't actually that hard to get to because I live east of London anyway. But then I was saying to Caroline on the day, moaning via Skype, I still have to get 3 trains to get there, and actually it's not that convenient. And I got annoyed. But yeah, so Salesforce World Tour, not so much on diversity this year. I mean, they it's an ongoing work with them, and they're always talking about it. I mean is, I didn't talk to them that much about it this year. I was more speaking to retailers.
Yeah, that was just a contrived link on my part, so...
It's not like you,
bro. Let's not overthink the link.
I was trying to make it better.
Okay, retailers. Let's get down to business.
Yeah.
Retailers at Salesforce.
Retailers at Salesforce. Mm. I spoke to Sweaty Betty, Pink Shirt Maker, and Co-op about their use of Salesforce. And then based on the back of some other things that I've heard on the retail networks recently, sustainability and their approach to it and their attitude towards it, and also social good, because stores are getting more embedded in experiential retail. People want to go.
Yeah, it's been a big theme with you, hasn't it?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. So people want to go to stores for a reason, and it's not always to buy stuff now. So a lot of retailers have taken the approach that, like, oh, well, if our stores are going to be places for experiences, we're all going to make sure that they're embedded in the local community. drawing the community in. If you help the community out and they feel like they have an affiliation with your brand, you're likely to get more customers, is the idea behind it. So that was quite cool. And the co-op do... the co-op have a sort of community feel to them anyway, I think.
That's the whole basis, isn't it? The cooperative.
Exactly. So, yeah. I was speaking to Claire Carroll at the co-op, so she is the head of customer services. And one of the things that we were talking about is a seamless customer journey. And because they offer so many different types of services, so not only do they have supermarkets, but they also offer insurance, and they have the co-op bank, and they do funeral services as well. So she was saying, you know, we want to be able to tell if a customer has recently buried a loved one with us, but then also might shop with us and have that overview of a customer as a whole. And that can...
Well, I've done both those things.
Oh, Brian. That's so sad. I'm so sorry. Exactly. And they want to know that about you so they can offer you the appropriate services. But she was saying...
Fantastic.
She used a nicer example as well. She said, what if you regularly buy dog food at one of their supermarkets, but they can see that you don't have pet insurance with them. Oh. You want to insure your dog. Mm. Yeah. So that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say things like, it's funeral. And they're like, funeral. Hey, here's some deals for Meals for One.
You're like, oh no.
Yeah, it's like, might be a bit morbid.
I did think of bringing something like that up, but I didn't have a lot of time, and I often go on these morbid tangents, so I actually didn't say that.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, being more customer-centric will involve customer surveys, getting feedback at scale and in real time. So that's another clunky connection to Caroline's story about SurveyMonkey.
Yeah, so they're quite an interesting company because they seem to be a company that everyone seems to know by name because you've probably filled in a SurveyMonkey survey. And that's kind of what I said when I interviewed the president of SurveyMonkey about their...
Is he American or British?
He's American. But yeah, it was about their European data centre opening plans. And I was like, hey, yeah, I know SurveyMonkey. And he was like, oh, so what products do you use? I was like, oh, I've done one of your surveys. He's like, there's a lot more to SurveyMonkey than that. So, yeah. So it was kind of... and as he was running through all their products and stuff, I was sitting there thinking, this is a Brian McKenna story. This is actually a Brian McKenna story because it's all about their business applications that are focused on, like you say, making better use and sense of sort of helping businesses make better sense and use of the data they generate, either from customers, random members of the public, or even employees. They have a lot of like employee, how to survey your employees about, you know, is this, you know, how do you rate the company as a place to work? Like, this manager has they, you know, how do you rate them? And they, you know, people use it over time. But actually, this manager's got worse. Like, you should fire them. So they are, the business applications company, really. But, I was talking to them because probably most notable recently, they went public, so they did an IPO last August. And so obviously the thing with shareholders is they want to see money. Yeah. So they've gone on a bit of I don't think it was just, you know, post-IPO, I think it's been in the run-up to it as well, but they've been going on a bit of a charm offensive with the enterprise. European enterprises in particular.
Okay.
So but they said about a third of their business at the moment comes from outside of the US.
Right.
And the bulk of that is European enterprises, but they didn't really give a further breakdown of that. But they want kind of to do more with European enterprises. And as I said, everyone kind of has probably done a SurveyMonkey kind of survey at some point.
Oh, yeah.
But they were saying kind of like the early years of the company, it was very, it was a lot of free users, like individuals in companies just, oh, okay, I've heard of SurveyMonkey, we'll just use this and we'll get customer data in through that way, we'll send some surveys out. But a lot of those were free customers as well. So they're trying to go through this transition that a lot of companies have gone through, like say Dropbox and things like that. You come in, it starts off as like a freebie, just like one seat in the company person using it. And then we want to turn that into a large scale.
It's the old land and expand.
Yes, exactly. I think that's what my subheading
strategy,
in the story was. So so they're going through that transition. And what was quite interesting from what the guy was saying is that, you know, they've always been this company that have come in through the back door. So when they've gone to approach CIOs, they can sort of say to them like, "Hey, how many people in your company are using SurveyMonkey?" And they're like, well, none as far as we know. And the guy's like, well, we can say to them, no, well, like, you've got 4,000 people in your enterprise using it. And they're like, okay. And he said, and that leads to a conversation about, so do you know what they're doing with that data? Do you know where it's being stored? Do you know if it's being plugged into any third-party applications as well? And a lot of times, CIOs don't have visibility of that.
Mm.
But when they're trying to court European CIOs on the other side of things, it's kind of like, oh, we can't use your software because you don't have a local data centre. So it's kind of, I just thought within the context, obviously, it's the one-year anniversary this weekend, GDPR.
Yeah.
GDPR.
There's this huge disconnect between, obviously, shadow IT, these products being bought in, CIOs still not really knowing how the data's being used, but then trying to go legit, like the other route of, like, hey, you can't use this because you haven't got locally hosted data. Mm. So that's why they're opening their European data centre.
So complicated. Do you remember when shadow IT was just like, oh, I use my phone to do work stuff?
Yeah, yeah, like sort of BYOD, and that seems to just died now.
It's interesting what you say about SurveyMonkey, because, you know, SAP acquired Qualtrics last year,
which
is a competitor to SurveyMonkey.
And they do similar stuff.
Yeah, and this was another thing that was like a ding, 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 Brian McKenna
story. Might be causing them to up their game, although, I mean, I did hear a very similar story from the former CEO of SurveyMonkey, Dave Goldberg, back in 2015 when I interviewed him. The husband, as then was, of Sheryl Sandberg, CEO of Facebook, and Dave sadly died shortly after I interviewed him couple of months later. He went running on a treadmill in a hotel, and he was on his own, fell over, and met his demise, unfortunately.
Yeah,
very nice man. I very much enjoyed interviewing him. He was good to interview. He had some very interesting things to say about the culture of Silicon Valley, its good side.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about the fact that they embrace failure, so failure is a virtue, and talked about people like the founder of Uber, Travis, having had a few failures before he had his success, and the founder of LinkedIn, etc. You know, they all had their failures before having success, and that's kind of something that's embraced in Silicon Valley. He said one thing that really has stayed with me, which is, because he did government and history at Harvard, and he was talking about the kind of institutional history being very important within, like, looking at government. And he said that one of the key things that people don't really understand about Silicon Valley, who've not been there, is all the kind of connective tissue that exists in the form of the services companies, so the PR firms, the accountants, the lawyers, and these people, generation after generation, have seen these 24-year-old entrepreneurs setting things up, and they can support them through that. And interestingly, at the time, he said that London had a very similar kind of institutional advantage in that way, because of the similar numbers of PR agencies and lawyers and accountants and so on.
Okay.
And he didn't really see any other European city apart from Berlin as having that kind of advantage.
He also spoke to you about diversity,
didn't he?
That there aren't enough women or ethnic minorities, and that there was ageism, so it's pretty much across the board not enough diversity.
He was saying, as an older person myself, he was 47 then, and
it's
that was
really
the year
old,
of his death.
Is
old, is it?
No, but if 47 is ageism in the tech industry.
And he also talked about that crap infrastructure and things like that. And could just come back to SurveyMonkey.
Yeah.
He said that one of the things I remember he said about their hiring policy was that they didn't hire any assholes.
Love it.
That was their number one rule. Hire no assholes.
I think that's,
so there you go.
I think that's standing quite a good stage.
Probably quite a good legacy.
That's amazing.
But he died far too young.
That's so tragic.
Yeah. But some of those themes of promoting innovation and developing your staff and diversity came up yesterday at an event which I did some fireside chatting.
Nice.
So I'm just going to do a quick call out. This is the Atlassian Future of IT event that occurred yesterday in London. Atlassian, known for their kind of issue tracking application Jira, and something called Confluence, which is some kind of knowledge management-y thing that software developers use. But anyway, so just a bit of a shout out to my lovely panelists. Sophie Wade, author of a book called Embracing Progress, founder of a company called the Flexcell Network. She's a very good speaker, actually, and she made a a really interesting point about empathy in the management of decentralized workforces.
Mm-hmm.
So her argument is that the more you have remote workers or decentralized or distributed teams, the more managers need to be imaginatively empathic,
mm-hmm.
In a way which, if you're sitting in an office watching all your employees, you don't really need to do that. One of the other panelists was Archana Rao, who's the CIO of Altasian. She said some very interesting stuff about how they organise themselves for thinking about the future of work and the kind of employees and talent they're going to have to bring in. Within her IT team, she actually has a group just focused on that. What their needs are going to be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, things like that. She said lots of other things, but for the interest of speech, I would just rattle through and touch on a couple of the other panellists. One was Claire Nelson, who's in a way is more in our kind of world of Computer Weekly readers, because she's the methods and tools technical lead at John Lewis.
Right.
And Claire did computer science and mathematics, joined John Lewis in 1996, I think. One of the many interesting things that Claire said was that when they set up johnlewis.com, they were thinking the business would amount to something like a medium-sized John Lewis store, whereas now it's like 30 to 50% of their revenue depending on the time of year.
It's a huge amount. It's funny because quite a lot of the retailers that I've spoken to in the last couple of weeks have spoken about how do you get that empathetic experience into the online space. Obviously, if you go in a shop, it's so much easier to connect to the emotional reason why you might be buying something than it is when you're online, you know?
Hmm.
Like suit making. If you're buying a suit for a wedding, for example, if you're a groom, that's going to be an emotional experience for you, and that's not necessarily the same kind of service that you get online. So actually, that's something that online is struggling with.
And that would apply to buying a kilt as well.
And a kilt.
Both those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to give a shout out to my final panellist, John Turley, digital transformation consultant at Adaptivist, who are a kind of services company based around Altasian's Ket. He made a very interesting point about he can now get the attention of really senior business people like CEOs and so on because of the sheer existential threat that's posed to their business by technology.
Yeah.
So previously the whole kind of aligning IT with the business, melding the two, that's been spoken about for years and years, decades in fact. But if you're you know, a travel company facing going out of business, unless you get your act together in terms of technology, if that's your situation, then the imperative really is much more there than it used to be. So I had meant to ask about dogs in the future of IT, in the future of work, but I completely forgot. Have you got any more events next week, Claire?
Next week I have a relatively event-free week.
Yeah,
the
me
week
too.
After, however, I have several again.
Same.
I'm going to an event at the Google campus about sustainability and fashion. And I'm also going to the Zendesk annual conference.
And yourself?
I'm
Caroline?
Not next week. Next week, it's pretty quiet for me, but the week after, off to Monaco for the annual Data Cloud conference, which is everything data centres, co-location.
Nice.
Everything like that. So it's kind of co-location providers and then the people who make data centre kit as well all kind of convene there, along with like Tech UK and stuff as well.
And are you going to bring back a present? Because that's something that I got absolutely slated for on the last podcast, was not bringing anything back from Spain for everyone.
Oh, I never do.
See? Yes! It's not just me.
Alex did.
I'm too busy news gathering to think
about
presents.
I've got other things to do.
Yeah, your reward is my words. As far as I'm concerned.
Alex brought back flavoured Kit Kats from Japan.
They
were good though.
Yeah, I don't have a sweet tooth, so lost on me. There we go.
I've got an event coming up in a few weeks, which is in Berlin.
If you don't bring sweets back.
So I will definitely be bringing something back, I promise.
Okay. We'll hold you to that.
Mm. Well, next week sounds like we're maybe going to be chilling out a bit. Got bank holiday.
You might.
Bank holiday Monday.
Chilling out.
You're going to jinx it. It's going to end up being a mad news week.
No.
Well, I mean, we do have the whole business of Brexit probably coming back on the agenda again.
I'm sure there'll be some Huawei stuff as ever.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right, well, maybe Huawei will probably come up again next week because the US seems determined to crush them.
So, got that to look forward to?
Yeah, cool.
Okay, well, that's all I've got time for this week. Just remains for me to say thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
To Claire.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.